You are listening to Spirit World Restless with DJ Judy on Spirit Plans Radio, broadcasting round the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more. Welcome to the second episode of this show. This time, we're going to turn the tables as I will be the interviewee. My friend Raymond Soulard Jr. and I had a phone conversation back in April 2011, wherein you will learn more about who the host of this show is and some of where I've been in my years so far. By putting myself in the spotlight, I hope to give you a better sense of my thinking and approaches to this show in future episodes. And now, here's the interview.
Hello, Jude. How are you?
Hi, Ray. I'm fine, thanks. And you?
Pretty good, pretty good. Well, now, I have a bunch of questions here, and even though I've known you for many years, there is lots of stuff here I don't know the answer to, so if I took a quiz on you, I probably wouldn't do very well. However, right. Hopefully after these questions have been answered, I would do much better, if that quiz ever comes.
Okay. Well, I will find out. I'll give you the quiz at the end.
Okay, so could you describe your path to Israel and how time and geography have changed your thinking and writing over the course of the years?
Yeah. Actually, I came to Israel just for a month vacation from a very cold winter in Toronto. And I went to a kibbutz, and I immediately smelled orange blossoms, something that was foreign to me living in winter Toronto. And I fell in love with the smell. Mm. After that, I was traveling around, and I went down to the Red Sea. At the time, it was owned by Israel. It was very safe and very beautiful and a natural paradise, really. And the more I saw the country, the more I loved it. And I just decided to stay. I never went back home.
Are you originally from Toronto?
Originally, I'm from Goshen, New York, and I moved to Toronto with my family when I was 3.
Oh, okay.
And,
so you,
I never really felt at home there very much.
So you started out in New York, and then you lived in Israel until, Toronto until you were how old?
I was in Toronto until I took this vacation. I was 24 when I left Toronto.
Okay, so you were still pretty much a young person when you decided to move to Israel.
Yeah, I was in the middle of a few different careers. I was doing children's theater, I was selling real estate, I was doing graphic design, and all kinds of things. I, you know, was enjoying life as it was, but something was missing, obviously, because when I came to Israel, I found it, which was simply feeling very much at home. The smells, the earth, the weather, it was just beautiful. I loved it.
And were you, did you go to Israel on a, what you might call a religious quest, with, as many people do, where
no,
they go?
No, not at all. It never occurred to me to move to Israel for any religious reason. In fact, I shunned the idea. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a very non-religious kind of background. I stayed in this. It was the agriculture. It was the earth. It wasn't anything to do with a religious calling, as I guess many people who come here feel. I certainly didn't. I just felt comfortable. Something, you know, it's difficult to say.
That's really interesting that you ended up embracing Israel for the land and for the place. It's funny that in America, Israel is, if you just hear people talking about Israel, it doesn't sound like a real place. It sounds like a place of gods and war and violence. It doesn't sound like a place where people do their laundry and watch television and smell orange blossoms, which is kind of funny.
Well, that's unfortunate. But remember, when I came here, we were just, it was a few minutes, a few months later that Menachem Begin made a peace treaty with Anwar Sadat, and things were looking very hopeful. It was a totally different situation. At the time, there were leaders who were aiming towards peace, and later on it changed.
So
dreadful. I mean, and by then it was too late. I'd already loved the place. I was here.
Yeah, you were committed. So that was in the late 70s when you came there.
It was very different. Yeah. But also, a lot of what you're reading in the media is totally unreasonable. what makes news is the sensationalism and not the truth of the country.
Right, and
it's hard to...
I'm sorry, go on.
I was just going to say it's very difficult to relate the truth if I tell you, for example, that this past weekend we were bombed and we had bombs in our chicken houses and a cow was killed, and it sounds like, whoa, how could I live here? And yet today I took a long walk around the fields, and as I did on Saturday, and again, it's peaceful. So the reality is you have to live here to understand that it's most of the time very idyllic, because I still believe that there can be peace here, and most of the time it's peaceful.
I think that part of the distorted perceptions of Israel from the United States have to do with the fact that three of the world's major religions have enormously important presences there, and so when people are brought up here who've not been there, they're brought up with the Israel and the general region as a ancient place of religious battle and God appearing as burning bushes and things like that. It's almost a mythological place like Middle Earth. It's not conveyed to people as a place where people just like us live.
There's been a lot of hype about the place.
And so,
but, you know, that's also it's based on fact. Every little grain of sand is filled with history. It's not a special vibe, okay? But a lot of the diatribe that we were fed from North America about what Israel is was part of the reason that I never myself ever considered living here.
Right.
When I came here, I saw a completely different reality. And I wish everyone could just pop over, take a look, even though it takes a little bit while longer to absorb what's going on here, but to decide for themselves rather than read in a newspaper, you know, that's publishing whatever it's publishing to make sales, not to broadcast the truth as it is.
Right, and then you've got the newspapers combined with the churches and the temples and the mosques that all are... I think essentially because the religions are old and because their teachings are old and because they don't really engage necessarily in adding new as meaningful chapters to their religious books, all of the teachings are historically ancient, and so... if you were just studying the Bible or studying one of the holy books, all you'd be reading about would be the tales of people from thousands of years ago. You wouldn't be reading, and you probably wouldn't get much of a schooling necessarily in where
well,
it is.
Okay.
All you would get
that's
from
a,
now would be the wars. You wouldn't
view,
get you wouldn't get the wisdom
of
now.
I don't think that point of view is relevant right now, because you're talking to me as someone who lives here.
Right, that's what I'm saying. I'm just talking about the misperception. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And it's always bothered me, because it seems to me like... it seems to me like... it wouldn't so much matter. I mean, it would be annoying, but it wouldn't so much matter if the United States was not such a powerful military and political presence there, while, meanwhile, simultaneously, most of its population doesn't have the least understanding of the place that their government has such a deep hands in. I mean, if we understood it better, then we would have more of a way of saying to the government, what you're doing is not right. But most people here don't know. They just know the distorted facts, and they know the ancient stories. They don't know the workaday, regular world that you and the other people there occupy. And so, if it wasn't for the fact that we have armies and bombs and we, you know, give money to different countries there and we shun different countries there. I mean, it's funny that this country, where I'm speaking to you from, is thousands of miles from where you are, and yet this country has huge impacts on how Israel lives and how the surrounding countries live. I mean, it's just, I've always thought it was kind of like, I don't even know what the right word is. It doesn't seem fair that part of how your lives are have to do with this country so far away with so many people who don't know what your lives are like. That's all I'm trying to say. That, you know, I mean...
We are like cousins. We're the only democracy here.
That's true.
We've always had a very good relationship. We're not under dictators. I mean, look at the mess that's going on in Egypt and Libya, and I mean, it's a complete mess. The people don't, the young energy that wanted to overthrow dictators no longer operates.
Right.
The people that took over don't know anything about democracy, and they have to implant the same kind of regime. They don't know what democracy is. And it's a problem when we're trying to talk peace to these other countries when they don't, there's no democratic process.
Right.
They're not partners of the same mind. I mean, we're hoping that over time, democracy will be something that's taught and learned, and people will begin to know they have rights. But right now, there's a huge difference in ways of looking at the world. And
right.
In the States, of course, you wouldn't know that because you don't live here.
Right, and that's my disturbance over time is realizing that how much of our government's leaders, how much of the decisions they make, the votes they take, the money they decide to supply, and to whom, who they give military help to, who they don't give military help to, who they bomb. I think a lot of it's based in ignorance and prejudice. I also think a lot of it is based in, for some of the leaders of this country, based in kind of a religious fanaticism that doesn't have to do with your day-to-day world, but has to do with ideas about how the world is going to end. I mean, there's ideas that the world is going to end because of Israel, because of the Middle East. It's not literal ideas. It's ideas written in prophecy, and yet our democratic republic here, there are people who are elected leaders here who operate with those ideas as primary, not the ideas of democracy, but actually
That's
the ideas
unfortunate.
Of... Yeah, and so...
That's unfortunate.
Yeah, and so that is what bothers me, because they are seeing Israel and the country surrounding it as part of a foreseen from ancient prophecy holy war that will end the world, and that influences who they give money to, who they send military help to, rather than looking at your country and the ones around you as the same earthy, occupied by people and animals and plants kind of places that this country is. I mean, that's why I'm saying the mythological aspect I find disturbing, and I think that it would
okay,
be probably...
That's something you have to deal with in your country. Unfortunately, America has turned into a very Christian country.
Well,
the Founding Fathers never intended it to be that way, and that's just what's happened.
Yeah, it swings... It's always been a part of things, and it swings kind of... It swings back and forth in terms of... who's in charge and who has the power at a given moment. There's enough of that kind of influence for it to be distressing. If it's one strand of many strands, that's fine, because tolerance is the watchword here for whatever.
Yeah, it's the key. Yeah.
But what happens is that instead of being one strand of many, it starts to kind of overwhelm a lot of the other strands and try to... I'm just thinking it's an interesting relationship between this country and Israel and the general Middle East that is probably unique. I don't think that the United States has such a vested interest in other countries. Like, if one were to look at the American relationship with countries in Africa, they would be probably based on oil, resources, supporting democracy. So all of these kind of, like, more mundane things, they wouldn't be based upon... these highfalutin right or wrong religious ideas, and that's where it's troubling.
I don't think it's all. I don't think it's what you're saying. I think that's part of it, but it's not the only reason America backs Israel.
It's not the only reason, because there's the political aspect. There's the supporting of
I'm
democracy.
Not sure what you're getting at here. Do you want to talk about America's view of Israel, or do you want to talk about me?
I'm sorry. I wandered into politics. Well, okay, so to move on, so when you moved from, as a little person you were in New York, and then as a young person you were in Canada, and then you moved to Israel as a young woman, and so you've lived in a number of different places over time, and so the other part of the question is, how has your thinking and writing over the course of the years changed because of where you've lived and who you've lived among?
Ah, that's really taking it to a different place. Okay,
yeah.
Let's see. All right, I actually started my my artistic theatrical life when I was very young, and I wrote plays, and I was a director. I was very confident and very, very sure that I had a message that I could direct and relate and entertain people. That was very young. I was, you know, 8, 9, 10. And really, and I found that public speaking was no problem for me. I was totally confident in my personality. That's when I started into puppetry, because I wanted more characters to play with. And then things started to get shaky in high school, I would say, and I stopped being so extroverted, and I started writing. And I started writing a book, and I wrote poetry, and I was mostly criticizing the superficial teenagers in my high school. I was more of I was an outsider, really. I'm feeling like an outsider, because most of them were into cheerleading and drinking on the weekends, and I wasn't into any of that. I found life fascinating. When I got to university, I took a course with Margaret Atwood, who was a mentor at the time, and I brought her my writing. And she, unfortunately for me, was very interested in the commercialization of my work. And so she had me rework everything I'd done. And her manner was such that it took the love out of what I was doing. And I had to take a break. So it was about a 20-year break. I stopped writing after that.
A 20-year break?
Yeah.
What can you give an example of what it was about her collaboration with you that led to such a long gap?
It wasn't a collaboration at all.
It was her telling you what to do.
It was her looking at my work and telling me no publisher would look at this unless it's formatted such and such a way. She looked at the format. You understand what I'm saying? Yeah, she was looking at the how rather than the content.
That
can be okay for some people, but for me, that wasn't what I wanted. I didn't want to be told how to send my work at that moment to be published. I wanted guidance in writing.
Well, now, let me ask you something. I could see that as kind of a, like, if a teacher had been working with you over the course of weeks, months, to get your writing polished to the point that you were happy with it and excited, and then said, okay, now before we actually send this off, we've got to make sure it's in the right form so that publishers will look at it. It sounds to me like she wasn't really emphasizing the content at all, because if she'd been emphasizing the content and then said at the end game, okay, you've got all this great work, now let's just, you know, make sure it's in the right font, that probably wouldn't have alienated you. Am I wrong?
No, what happened was, I think she hated being there, or she hated the fact that I came to her for advice. Whatever it was, she agreed to be my mentor and yet did not act as a mentor.
So she didn't sit down with your work and really get to know it and help you think it through?
No. There was no process. There was no process. There were meetings in which she would say yes, no, yes, no.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of the meetings were interrupted with her having conversations with other people on the phone, or she was very caustic. I got the feeling that she really felt herself above the position that she found herself in. In any case, my personal reaction to her was such that I just zoomed in the other direction, and I didn't get into creative writing at all until I was totally in a comfort zone again, where I could explore my own mind without thoughts of publishing and without that critical eye.
Yeah, that's was she famous at the time? Was her mind diverted?
Yes,
by...
she's always been famous. She was born famous. She was very famous in Toronto. She's from Toronto.
So she was.
She's not as famous as she is now, of course. But.
Right. So her mind was distracted by a lot of ambitious projects and things.
Other things, yeah. I thought a woman in publishing who made it good would help another young woman. That was my thought at the time.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like You know, quite honestly, it sounds like she did not belong in the position of teacher. It sounds like she probably took the job because she needed the money, or maybe someone talked her into it, but that it really wasn't a good fit for her. I wonder if she's still teaching these days.
She wasn't teaching then. She was a writer in residence.
Oh, okay. I gotcha.
Yeah.
So she really didn't know what she was doing.
The writer in residence in university has certain, you know, duties, and there's a reason they're brought there.
Yeah.
And she agreed to be a mentor. So it just wasn't a good fit for me. Maybe someone else would have slid in there and been extremely happy, but I wasn't.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, as a teacher, you've been a teacher for many years, and you know that you're going to get all sorts of personalities coming to see you in your office, and you kind of got to do your best to groove with all of them. You can't just fit with the ones that you happen to think like, and the rest of them kind of shun, you know? I mean, it sounds like she didn't do right by you, but it's really unfortunate that... It's interesting. Okay, so to move along, you had this bad experience with her. You didn't write again for 20 years.
Yeah, I had a bad experience with her. But I still... When I went into a different field, I went into theater. Do you hear me?
Yeah, you went into theater.
Yeah, I went into theater, and in children's theater, and my detour was helping children write their own plays. I took on the role of mentor for other people.
Oh.
I stepped back from my own creativity and helped others, because I knew that's what I was missing for me. I wanted to help others.
Right.
And when I came to Israel for a month vacation, and I stayed, I was on a kibbutz called Ein Shefet, which is a kibbutz formed by Americans and Polish. It's one of the oldest kibbutzim. And I wanted to stage some children's theater, so we took Snow White, and I did it in English, and I wanted to just leap back into that field when I came here. It was very fascinating to me, very creative, and that's what happened. And I wanted to start an English theater here,
right?
And I didn't find anything. I didn't find anything at all until I found someone who was making puppets.
You found what?
Who was making puppets.
You found someone who was making puppets?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I sat in with him. I acted as an apprentice. I learned his technique. I was in his puppet show. We filmed it. And as a director, he wasn't very good. So I took the technique and I made my own puppets. I built my own puppet shows. I did work in English with puppets. And I took it from there. And then I started having kids. Mm-hmm. And with that, I had no time to make puppets anymore, and I started writing. Someone gave me a computer, and I started writing, saving my stuff, and grabbing minutes here and there, and I came back to writing. So that was about a 20-year break. Yeah. Or more, even.
Do you, can you...
That's the difference, yeah?
Can you think about, with, aloud with me, about how that 20-year break affected the writing? I mean, what were you as a writer 20 years prior to when you resumed? What was different? I imagine a lot.
Uh-huh. Okay. 20 years prior, I had been totally in my own head. Okay? My own mind, my own imagination, purely my own identity, exploring that.
Right.
And then 20 years left me a lot of time for exploration, exploring other people's ideas, doing other things, dancing, painting, all kinds of other forms of expression, but from the point of view of other people's ideas, borrowing people's ideas, trying them out, doing Tai Chi, doing rhythmic gymnastics, doing bookbinding, all kinds of other things to get a taste of other places, reading voraciously. And then when it came down to sitting in front of a computer after giving birth, all of that stuff cooked up inside me, and I could grab from all those experiences to relate stories, to write short stories about characters, fictional characters, or caricatures of people I've known. It changed. It evolved into something totally new. And it was interesting to read. And it was a solitary act, and yet I met a lot of English speakers, and I joined writing groups, and we got together and motivated each other to get better. So, I don't know. It was a social kind of thing until the wars started. The first war was in 1991. That was the first war I'd been through here.
Right.
And that's when I discovered writing as therapy. Because I had to somehow express the feeling of not knowing if it was day or night. There was no normal clock in a war situation.
Right.
And writing just kept me sane. It was wonderful. And that's how it's been since.
Let's pause this interview long enough to clear our mental palates with some music by Jim White, a song I love called Still Waters.
Shut up down in Mobile with a girl from New York City. She woke me up one night to tell me that we weren't alone. She said she saw the ghost of a woman staring at me. To worry, but in the morning when I woke up, she was gone. And so I headed on to Florida, where I tangled with some sailors. As I lay bloody on the wharf, I cursed the ship they sailed on. Ship sank into the ocean. You know there's projects for the dead, and there are projects for the living. Though I must confess, sometimes I get confused by that distinction. And I just throw myself into the arms of that which would betray me. See how far Providence will stoop down just to save me. And it's all because still waters run deep in me. Cause I've got this crazy way. It's just a crazy way I'm swimming in still waters.
You are listening to Spirit World Restless with DJ Judy on Spirit Plans Radio, broadcasting round the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more.
How do puppets show up in your writing?
At the moment, puppets don't show up in my writing.
Puppets don't show up.
Puppets only show up in my writing when I hold a puppet on my hand and I create an improv play. Okay, that's when they show up.
Okay.
But painting shows up, and meditation shows up, and sort of a synesthesia where I hear colors and I, you know, see sounds. That that enters in, and the more I use painting or music or something like that in my daily life, the more I exercise those facilities within myself, the more it shows up in my words.
Yeah, I was thinking that I was thinking that given that you've really seriously pursued these other art forms, they would have to be present either more or less obviously in your writing and at different times.
Yeah.
So that kind of answers the second question I'd asked. We kind of glided from the first to the second. The next question is, so once you were a girl and then a woman and now a woman with a husband and grown or nearly grown children, what are you aware of in your changing consciousness that shows up in your poems?
Okay. First of all, I don't have a husband. I've been living with my partner for over 33 years, but we're not married.
Okay, woman with a partner and children.
Yeah, and children. What's your question? What are you aware of the changing consciousness? Okay. Well, I think I answered it.
Well,
but
this is,
let's just summarize it.
Well, this is more about... so the last question was more about your... Well, somewhat more about your art, the different arts you pursued. Like, you pursued writing, then other arts, and now writing again, and how that's all kind of culminated in how you work now. This one is more about the people in your life who are intimately important, your partner and your children, and the fact that you've a single person, like the person you were when you arrived in Israel when you were 24, you were a single young woman, and now some years later you have these daily intimate relations. Those things change a person over time. I mean, maybe you did kind of answer it by saying that you're no longer just writing about yourself, but I was just interested in pursuing it in terms of the personal relationships that have grown up over time.
Hmm.
Did you play with puppets with your kids when they were little?
My kids, from the first time they popped out of me, I was hoping I'd have a partner in puppetry, you know?
Begging them
to put on a puppet and get with me on stage, because I didn't find anyone to work with in puppetry. My daughter refused, but she was often a character in my puppet shows, and she enjoyed them.
Oh, okay.
She would ask me to perform for her, and I would always include her in my shows. She would be a character.
Mm-hmm.
I would use my families in puppet shows, okay?
Oh.
I would use them all the time, caricaturizing, mm-hmm. satirizing.
Mm-hmm.
My second son also, nope, not a chance. By the way, my first daughter is a brilliant artist and a designer, and she's musical, she's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
My second son is a brilliant guitar player and a very amazing photographer.
Mm-hmm.
My third son, he, thank God, allowed himself to join the puppetry, and he came behind the stage with me to perform now and then,
mm-hmm.
and he was just a more carefree kind of kid, much more confident, much more social, and he had no problem working with puppets. My last daughter, she's also a guitar player, but she's afraid of my puppet.
Afraid of them?
She doesn't like them whatsoever.
Oh, my
God.
She
thinks they're scary, yeah.
And how about your partner?
So, I once dreamed that I would do the jazz puppets and he would play the music. He's a jazz musician,
uh-huh.
but we never got that off the ground. But it's, you never know. It might happen, yeah. The good thing with puppets is you can do it at any age, as long as you're alive.
Right,
you can do
a
puppet show. Let's see. Did I answer your question in any form, Ray?
Maybe it wasn't a very good question. What I was thinking of was I was thinking about how a person's consciousness, even whether they're doing art or not, how a person's consciousness of themselves and of the world changes over time as they get older and as their important relationships change and grow and develop. And I was thinking about how the passage of time and the changing and growth, the decay even of relationships, you can look at a person's artwork production over time, and you can almost pull out biographical strands. Well, this is a period of time when they were living alone, and this is a period of time when they were involved with this person or that person. This is a period of time when they lived on a commune, or this is a period of time when they were depressed and isolated. And there's not always a one-to-one correlation. The depressed times don't always produce depressed art, and the happy times don't always produce happy art. But it's interesting that because we live in time and we live among relations, I think our art is affected by those things, whether directly or indirectly. And so the fact that you've gone from being a child in New York to being a young person among your family in Toronto to coming to Israel, where you basically, you and your partner created your own family, I would imagine that your artistic concerns, as well as your methods and even your abilities, would have evolved over time because of those changing landscapes and people. But I don't know what the answer to that is. Maybe it's just a complicated observation.
As you know, as we grow older, every day, every second, we're evolving.
Right.
And the people around me and my surroundings, of course, influence me. Of course. Thinking about it as a timeline kind of situation, I just have to say that as a kid, and probably as most people would say when they're children, I was very confident that I knew the answer, that my voice was special, and I was very possessive of that voice. I didn't really want anyone else to read my work. I didn't even want to belittle it by publishing. Perhaps that's another problem I had with Margaret Atwood. I thought of publishing as selling out. I believed writing was something almost sacred and holy, and I felt it very part of me, not something for sale.
Yeah, I understand that completely. I know you do.
Definitely. As I get older, the words shrink. That's why I'm so into haiku right now, because I'm trying to erase my own ego as much as possible. It's not me. It's trying to be as clean as possible to describe a feeling or an image or an experience.
Mm.
And that's a constant search. And of course, my family, or each person in my family, is amazing. Each one has their own search, as does my partner.
Yeah.
And we're all trying to improve ourselves as human beings and as artists.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just finding it becoming more minimalistic is what's becoming important to me.
Okay, so that kind of brings this question round to its conclusion, because so essentially from where you started as a young person to now, the current step on the path is a kind of is haiku in a lot of ways. Though I must say that, I mean, I like your poems whether they're haiku or not. I think your haiku are I don't think haiku is an easy form simply because it's short. In fact, I think it's somewhat harder because it's an attempt to pull something from the world in a few words and make it lay on the page meaningfully. And I think you do it really well.
Thank you.
But it's interesting that haiku is something you arrived at as more of your writing. I mean, you've always written haiku, but it's interesting that it's become a more predominant form for you, and the reasons why. I mean, I think that that's an interesting thing. The next question is, you live in Israel, known for its religious significance. How does this play through your writing, if at all? How is it different from other places for the practicing artist?
Okay, as I said before, walking in the land here is unlike any other place.
Right.
You can't deny it. There's biblical history in every grain of sand. For example, last time I was in northern New York State, where I was born,
right,
I really felt the Native American vibe, and it was very deja vu for me. I don't know, you know, where it comes from, but I really felt a heavy vibe there. But in this country, right now I'm living in the desert, on a kibbutz in the desert, and when I walk the paths and I walk on the sand and I see a seashell, mm-hmm. you know, or I see an old ancient coin, it happens, or a nail, some kind of bizarre thing from the past, it just rings with history.
Right.
And that unavoidably enters into my being.
Mm-hmm.
But as I told you, I don't think of Israel as a religious country because of me. I live in a secular kibbutz.
Right.
I don't deal with religion. It's not part of my life. There's a very fanatic minority of religious that unfortunately have a large say in politics. They change coalition government situations, and it's ridiculous. But I just want to stress the fact that I live in a place where there is no religion, okay?
That's
there are certain kibbutzim in Israel that are religious.
Right.
Okay, but this one is not. People are not religious here. Okay?
That's interesting. Okay. I didn't know that. Okay, so to bring it down from the larger issues of this, of religion and so on, to you, how do your spiritual views, your personal spiritual views, wind their way through your writing?
I am what I am. If I'm feeling spiritual, actually, I don't like that word.
What word would you prefer? Philosophical?
No.
Okay.
No. I prefer real.
Okay.
Real.
Well, I'm just talking about the things that you value and care about, and the ways that you see the world, that kind of thing. I mean, I don't know what the right word is, but I'm talking about you as opposed to another person. You know, how is your writing inflamed with how you perceive the world? What does your writing emphasize in your own view about the world?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if I can answer it. As I said before, I'm trying to limit the presence of my personality. I'm trying to not express my personality. I'm trying to see things as clearly as possible. That's why I just use the descriptive word real. I'm trying to see what I see.
Yeah.
And sometimes I see things that are very amusing, and I try and write it that way.
Yeah.
Sometimes I see things that are absurd or very sad, and I try to write them that way.
Right.
I don't think spiritual. I am who I am, and I've always felt in a way like I have an innate purpose. I have something that I need to do,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know if that's spiritual or just trying to exercise every facet of my being. And when I write, I try to use as much of myself as I can without inserting myself. Does that answer your question?
Well, I think it answers it. Yeah, I think it does, as a matter of fact. I think that because the way a person perceives himself or herself is going to be reflected in the kind of art they produce. And so if your writing is currently not inwardly directed, but more outwardly directed, your art is going to, of course, reflect that. That's which way you're looking. So, I think that that's fine. So, who are your poetic models, famed and otherwise? And was there a first hero who inspired you to try your hand at poetry?
I love Diane de Prima. I think she's amazing.
Right.
Of course, Allen Ginsberg. Whenever I feel dry or worried, I just listen to him.
Mm-hmm.
His Sunflower Sutra, or Supermarket in California, or parts of Howl. I just listen to him,
mm-hmm.
or any of his recordings, and I just feel inspired within seconds. I can listen to Martina Newberry. She inspires me.
Mm-hmm.
I listen to the great haiku poets Basho and Issa,
mm-hmm.
and of course Kerouac.
Right.
First hero. I started writing poetry, I guess, around the age of 14. And at the time, I was influenced by people like Paul Simon, for his vocabulary.
Yeah.
I loved it that when he wrote his songs, I'd have to turn to the dictionary. I thought that was brilliant. And Dylan for his intensity. And Walt Whitman for his lush passion that always was amazing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And Virginia Woolf for her lyrical prose.
Mm-hmm.
When I read her, I felt something stir inside me, something open up, and I knew that I could do that too. It felt like a sister kind of influenced me. She was amazing when I first read her. Any other questions about that?
No, I just have one last, I only have one last question, and you may have answered it already, or may not, you may surprise me. Is there a poetic form of any kind that you wish to master?
Yeah, I see you. I thought I was sick of poetic forms. I thought, you know, I hate when people purposely rhyme or have to write sonnets. I couldn't stand it.
Right.
And then suddenly, Martina Newbery posted a gazelle, G-H-A-Z-A-L, on an online forum,
mm-hmm.
you know, Arcanum. She posted it on arcanumcafe.com.
Uh-huh.
And it was so refreshing. The format was just fascinating to me. It was couplets
mm-hmm.
where you repeat a certain idea and there's supposed to be some form of rhyme, but I didn't quite do the rhyme. But I found it very interesting to explore that form. I was able to insert my style, my way of looking at the world
mm-hmm.
into a form, and I liked it. But whether or not I would want to master that form, I don't think so.
Well,
I think haiku offers me the frame that I like most. And the more I'm writing haiku, I'm even getting away from three lines. I'm getting more into two lines or one line haiku. And it's right now, that's what I'm just doing.
You know, I had an experience years ago where I was writing really long poems for a long time, and then I decided to switch up and write much shorter poems. I thought of it as going from an electric guitar phase to an acoustic guitar phase.
Yeah.
But writing shorter poems can be a really good discipline. It can really, it forces your mind to winnow away everything that is interesting but not completely relevant to what you're getting at, and you keep carving and carving. It's like you have a small stick and a knife, and you've just got to make your cuts in the stick very carefully so that you don't end up ruining it.
And I want to thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this hour. I'll leave you now with one of my own poems, accompanied by Chukwai Billy on keyboards and synthesizer, and also some music by Asaf Avidan, The Reckoning Song. Sitvar, sitar. Sari slips off the shoulder. Dance in barefoot gesture. Flies, arms rise, dance, knees open as mountain sides. Sitar, sitar, bubbles wonder, a stroke, a turn. Bindi binds her, pose, shanti, kick. Music rush, sitar, sitar. Sitar, sitar. Slips off the shoulder. Tabletop. Where flies, arms.
My heart is dry. I don't laugh and I don't cry. I don't think about you all the time, but when I do, wonder why. You had to go out of my door and leave just like you did before. I know I said that I was sure, but rich man can't imagine Paul. One day, baby, we'll be old. Oh, baby, we'll be old and think of all the stories that we could have told. So one day, baby, we'll be old. Oh, baby, we'll be old and think of all the stories that we could have told. Little me and little you kept doing all the things they do. They never really think it through like I can never think it true. Here I go again, the blame, the guilt, the pain, the hurt, the shame, the founding fathers of our plane. That's stuck in heavy clouds of rain. One day, baby, we'll be old. Oh, baby, we'll be old and think of all the stories that we could have told. One day, baby, we'll be old. Oh, baby, we'd be old and think of all the stories that we could have told. I said, one day, baby, we'd be old. Oh, baby, we'd be old and think of all the stories that we could have told. I said, one day, baby, we'd be old. Oh, baby, we'd be old. Oh, baby, we'd be old. So, baby, we'd be old. Oh, baby, we'd be old. So baby, we'd be old. So baby, we'd be old. Baby, we'd be old. Baby, little pretty baby. Little baby, pretty little baby, baby, baby. One day, baby, we'll be old. Oh, baby, we'll be old. Think of all the stories that we could have told.